As we stand on the brink of the years and see a world slipping away and a new one being born, O God of timeless truth and eternal life, we presume to pray unto thee, who has been our help in ages past. Hear the prayers of thy servants as we seek inner strength, that we may be able to confront our times with a clear and an unevasive mind. As we prepare to leave the shelter of these dedicated halls and to depart from the concerned care and inspiration of these consecrated leaders and teachers, we suddenly realize that which we face: a world torn with dissension, the challenge to make real the brotherhood and equality of opportunity we claim as our American civil heritage, to accomplish the feat of exploring space, to delve deeper into the vast magnitude of the capability of man's mind, and to go deeper into the human soul, that we may have a clearer insight of thee. And as we go into the stream of life about us, O God, may we go not with cynicism or doubt, but in the spirit of hope to which we are called. Drop the plumb line of thy judgment on the walls of our lives. Weigh in the balance of thy truth the accomplishments of our skill and science. Test with thy consuming fire the permanent worth of our industry and art. If the earth be shaken and the foundations crumble and our world tumbles about us, grant us the courage to look beyond the ruin to that which has not fallen, because it is of thy eternal verities. And stumbling across the rubble created by man's callousness and cruelty, may we grasp the dreams we dream and come to see a world dwelling in peace and concord. May thy particular blessing be upon each of these thy servants, to inspire those beginning and to sustain those who have already given so much. And so we pray, O God, that thou wilt help us to walk in the way of deep intent, of serious single-mindedness, and of the unyielding persistence, until at last we come to the fullness of thy heavenly kingdom. Through Christ Jesus our Lord, in whose name we pray, amen.
Mr. Rasmussen, members of the Board of Regents, Dr. Bunch, Mr. Field, Dr. Keller, Mr. Snodgrass, honored guests, faculty, candidates for degrees, parents, families of candidates, students, Alaskans, and friends of the University of Alaska. The University of Alaska today is observing its 39th annual commencement, an occasion which is the culmination of many years of effort and work, an occasion which has many separate meanings for each of us, and is yet much more the sum of these separate meanings. It is only fitting and proper that we begin today's observance with thoughts of the Arctic and the subarctic, the natural environment of the farthest north university of the world. As Alaskans, we all know the feel of the brisk, sharp north wind, the shimmering beauty of the northern lights, the sparkle of sun on ice and snow, the tremendous power of the cold, and the awe of the Arctic. And consequently, there is no person more eminently qualified to bring us today's first commencement address than the man whom it is my honor and privilege to present to you. Our speaker certainly needs no introduction to old-time Alaskans, for at the time when the university was putting down roots in the golden heart of Alaska as the pioneering Alaska Agricultural College and School of Mines, our speaker was starting his career as a glaciologist, geographer, and explorer by conducting research in the Fairweather Range Prince William Sound, Glacier Bay, and other areas of southeastern Alaska. He studied, and is still studying, one of our special natural features, glaciers, and has become world-renowned for his work in this special field. His studies have taken him from the North Pole to the South Pole and completely around the globe, wherever conditions in his special field allowed exploration. Our speaker does the University of Alaska and all the citizens of the 49th state great honor by coming to us today. Ladies and gentlemen, it is my high privilege to present to you today's first commencement speaker, Mr. William B. Osgood Field of New York City.
President Wood, distinguished guests, members of the class of 1961, and friends of the University of Alaska. I find it difficult to express in words the pleasure and honor of being with you here today. This occasion I shall always cherish. I'm extremely proud to be here with you, to share in this beautiful weather, and to enjoy the hospitality for which Alaska is rightfully noted. The university has indeed prospered since my first visit to the campus in 1927. When the Alaska Agricultural College and School of Mines was still very young. Dr. Bunnell showed me around the university, the college that day. Day in summer, we were just tourists. Today, the reputation of this institution has kept pace with the tremendous growth and development of Alaska. The fundamental change from territorial status to that of being not only our largest state, but also one of the great states of the Union. For us outsiders, it has always been exciting to be identified with Alaska. Whether we came here primarily to view your magnificent varied scenery, to see your treasure of wildlife, or to study the features of your landscape. My last visit to Fairbanks was for none of these reasons, but as part of a cold weather test detachment of the Army of the Air Force, which was assigned to Ladd Field during the winter of 1943. One of many features of that winter which I remember and which is pertinent to our subject were the temperatures in January and February. January averaged 10 degrees below normal, and February 6 degrees above normal. One was known as a cold month, the other as a comparatively warm one. But despite this, life went on as usual. You wore an extra sweater in January, and you saved on your fuel bill in February. My point in bringing this up, as these departures from the mean monthly temperatures were well within the range, which if extended for the whole year and continued for many, many years, would be sufficient to produce a glacial period on the one hand, or the other extreme, an interglacial period, with much less ice and snow on the mountains than at present. The difference in climate involved is not greater than that between the average temperatures of our unusually warm or unusually cold months in summer and winter. Thus, in discussing glacial and interglacial periods, we are dealing with ranges of climate which are part of our everyday experience and merely need to be indefinitely prolonged to produce tremendous changes on Earth. For a few moments, I would like to point out some of the changes in the glaciers that have occupied in the very recent past, say the last two centuries, which have occurred during this period. We can only touch on a few points very briefly. And if you'll permit me, I should like to discuss the glaciers of Alaska because they're my favorites and I think the most interesting. There is still much to be learned about all this, and there's much to be done by the combined efforts of geologists, hydrologists, physicists and geophysicists, meteorologists and climatologists, botanists and geochemists to determine what is going on now, what has been going on in the past, the causes involved, and for practical application, I hope that in time there may be a better basis for predicting future changes of climate. In studying the glaciers, we are, of course, dealing with one feature of our environment, which is closely related to climate and climatic change. So this subject is considerably broader than just concerned with ice itself. Also, by studying in detail what is going on at present we may find a lot of answers to the great problems of the geological past. My own concern with the problem began in 1926, when as part of a college term paper, many of you have heard of such things, I read Harry Fielding Reid's Geological Survey Report, Glacier Bay and its Glaciers, describing his observations in 1890 and 1892. In that report, he predicted many changes in Glacier Bay during the next half century. Some glaciers were doomed to disappear, while others could be expected to continue to recede and to open up new inlets and expose new terrain. As of 1926, Reid himself had not gone back to check these predictions, but others had attempted to follow in his footsteps. However, there was a lack of continuity and systematization, and many of the details of what was happening were lost, and some fairly significant events were being missed entirely. My thought was to begin young, and if possible, to carry out periodic observations throughout a normal lifetime and actually observe and record in surveys and photographs some of the major and minor changes which would occur during this period. In 1926, we started in Glacier Bay, followed up in 1931 with studies in the Prince William Sound area. After these initial trips, which served to tie in our observations with those made by the pioneers in this work in the 1890s and the early years of this century, we returned every few years and then followed up with a series of field trips as part of the International Geophysical Year program in 1957, 1958, and we extended it also in 1959. These provided an opportunity to revisit almost all the areas we had previously studied and to extend the work to other localities. Since 1940, the work has been coordinated under the sponsorship of the American Geographical Society, to whom my colleagues and I are deeply indebted for making possible this continued effort and the attempt to achieve a measure of coordination. We also worked in cooperation with the Research Committee on Glaciers, the American Geophysical Union, in assembling an archive of source materials, mostly consisting of dated photographs, including those taken by aerial surveys. This collection has now grown to a very considerable proportion. It is housed at the Society in New York as part of the IGY Glaciology Data Center. And this we are supported by the National Science Foundation. And having mentioned the International Geophysical Year, I'd like to just make a little aside at this point that while a great deal of information was gathered during that 18 months of intensive observation, if you ask me what I think was the most important feature of that period, I think I would say that it was the chance for scientists of all the nations to come together, to get to know each other. And this happened. They learned to know each other's problems. We exchanged Christmas cards, and these Christmas cards, I can assure you, go backwards and forwards across from this side of the earth to the other. This, I think, was very important. Then a new continent was, not a new continent, but a continent was sort of absorbed for the first time by all nations, and subsequently a treaty was signed which provided for the peaceful scientific study of that continent. That's the Antarctic. And this is probably the only place on Earth where we're all working together, where by treaty, there's no fussing and fuming about armament. We are cooperating. The American is at the Russian base. The Russian scientists at the American base. This may be a part of the world that's rather remote at this time, but it's a step in the right direction, perhaps, towards international cooperation and better understanding, which transcends all other problems at this time. Now, despite our efforts to be systematic in our observations, there are great gaps in our coverage, and altogether too many years have elapsed between visits to some of the important localities. Others, of course, have also made observations of a similar nature, while air photography has become increasingly useful in studying glacier behavior. What are some of the principal things that have been seen and recorded by photography and surveys? Here I wish I could show you comparative pictures, so they tell a more vivid story than mere words can accomplish. If we had seen only receding glaciers, there would not be any great problem to be investigated, except perhaps to record the rate of shrinkage. But the situation is nothing like so simple. This is particularly true in Alaska. While we can say that most glaciers in Alaska, as indeed in most parts of the world outside of Antarctica, are apparently receding, there are many exceptions. Alaska has more than its share
of these exceptions, which is one of the reasons this area is so interesting. Here we find instances of very rapid recession, some glaciers which have been relatively stable for decades, some which have been advancing almost continuously since first observed, and others which have had periods of both advance and recession in the last few decades. Moreover, some advancing glaciers are in close proximity to those which are receding. There are many qualifications and explanations which we cannot go into here. But there are also a great many questions to which, as yet, there are no really adequate explanations. Our first objective has been to try to record what has happened. The correlations and explanations must follow. As yet, I'm afraid we have not gone much beyond the first stage. But as the period of observations continues, we should begin to make more meaningful interpretations. Perhaps the most startling thing is the contrasting conditions found in different areas. The best example is in the southern St. Elias Mountains, among the glaciers flowing from the east and west flanks of the Fairweather Range. On the east slope, during the last 1 3/4 centuries, the great glacier which formerly filled Glacier Bay has disappeared. This actually happened between Vancouver's visit in 1794 and John Muir's visit in 1879, during which recession totaled about 45 miles, and a thickness of up to 3,000 to 4,000 feet of ice vanished. I know of no other place on Earth where this has happened to that magnitude. During the same period, on the west slope of the Fairweather Range, just less than 20 miles away, subject presumably to the same general climatic conditions, the glaciers at Latilla Bay advanced 2.5 to 3 miles between La Perouse's visit in 1786 and the observation of the Canadian Boundary Survey in 1894. Perhaps if we could understand what produced such a catastrophic recession on one side of a narrow mountain range and a substantial advance on the other, we would begin to understand the delicate mechanism which tip the scale as to whether glaciers grow or shrink. Elsewhere in Alaska, we also find startling changes. From air pictures, we know that McCarty Glacier, on the southern side of the Kenai Peninsula, receded 12 miles between 1927 and 1950. While not far away, glaciers hardly changed during this period. On the other hand, a few glaciers have been steadily advancing since the termini were first accurately surveyed in the 1890s. Three of the larger glaciers of Prince William Sound have within the last few decades been destroying trees, which are several hundred years old, indicating that the ice has not been this far forward for centuries, possibly much longer. The station we set up in 1935, which was 1,500 feet from the terminus of Harvard Glacier, had been overrun when we returned in 1957. At the head of Yakutat Bay, the Hubbard Glacier, one of the longest valley glaciers outside the polar region, possibly the longest, has advanced about a mile since first visited by I.C. Russell in 1890. If this advance continues at the same rate as during the last 70 years, the entrance of Russell Fjord will be blocked before the end of this century, as it was in the 18th century, and a new lake 40-odd miles in length will again be formed. Near Juneau, Taku Glacier has continued the advance, which was first noticed soon after 1900, has come forward some 3 3/4 miles. The glacier is now beginning to cover, once again, the terrain from which it receded in the latter half of the 18th century. The behavior of these glaciers is not only something of a mystery, affording a nice scientific problem, but from a practical standpoint, they present other kinds of problems. If it were not for the Taku Glacier, the west shore of Taku River could be used for a highway connecting Juneau, or at least tidewater in Taku Inlet, with the Alaska highway system. As it is, with the glacier steadily advancing, there's a possibility that it will again dam Taku River, such as is believed to have occurred in the middle of the 18th century. If the rate of advance maintained since 1900 continues, the glacier would reach the opposite shore of the valley in the 1890s, in the 1980s. At Lake George in the Chugach Mountains, 40 miles east of Anchorage, Knik Glacier now dams up Lake George in winter, and the impounded water is released rather suddenly into Knik River in summer. The resulting flood is sometimes quite serious in the valley below, where people live and there are railroad and highway bridges. It would take only a slight change in the glacier, either to dam very much more water, which might result in greater floods, or cease to form a dam so that the lake would disappear entirely. Although the Fairbanks area is not threatened by glaciers and was not even covered by ice during the last ice age, when cities like New York and Chicago were buried in ice, this is one of the interesting complexities of the problem. It might be well to consider that if the glaciers to the south of us were to re-advance to the position they occupied 2 centuries ago, the Alaska Railroad would be threatened at several places in the Kenai Mountains. The Richardson Highway would be threatened, where it crosses the Alaska Range in the valley of the Delta River and again in the Chugach Mountains near Thompson Pass. And the route of the new highway along the old road bed of the Copper River Railroad would probably be closed entirely. In southeastern Alaska, the valleys of the Taku and Stikine Rivers would likely be blocked or rendered impassable. Navigation along the inside passage would be more hazardous because of an increase in iceberg discharge into these waters. Where highways skirt the mountain front, as in so many places here in the interior, the streams issuing from glaciers would be subject to higher water and more flash floods from the breaking out of ice dammed lakes. While this is pure speculation, there's nothing whatever to suggest that general advances such as occurred in the 17th and 18th centuries will not occur again. In fact, from the study of the past, it is a fairly sound prediction that these events will be repeated. The question is when. Before the days of air communication, the closing of the mountain passes and valleys leading from the coast to the interior would have been more serious. We do have more alternatives now. In addition to airlift capabilities, we have reached the point where man may be able to do something effective about artificially controlling glaciers where the threat poses serious economic consequences. Great dams in the Alps both serve to store water and form lakes, which in some instances extend up to the glaciers and serve as an additional melting agent to keep them from advancing destructively down their valleys. Some modification of climate may also be possible before the end of this century. However, before attempts are made to modify the climatic environment of a glacier, it would be desirable to know a lot more about the magnitude of change in meteorological factors which are needed to produce the difference between an advancing, stable, or receding glacier. This can only be learned by detailed studies of glacial meteorological relationships over the whole area of the glacier. As we might expect, many of these phenomena occur in other parts of the world as well. The Alps remain the classical area for glacier studies because of the long history of observation, accessibility, the economic importance of the glaciers as sources of water, as objects of tourist travel, and the ever-present possibility of advances such as occurred in the 18th and 19th centuries, which damage villages, farmland, and threaten routes of travel. However, there is nothing in the Alps such as the magnitude of recession in Glacier Bay, nor the opportunity to study glaciers which have been advancing more or less steadily for 6 or more decades. While there have been some advances in the Alps during the last century, there have been no surges of the magnitude of those at Mozo or Black Rapids glaciers in the Alaskan Range, in the Alaska Range, or the many other advances which have occurred in other parts of Alaska. Alaska thus presents a unique place for the study of this type of phenomenon. We have glaciers of all kinds, except those found exclusively in the polar region. Although glaciers cover only about 3% of the state, they are extensive, widely distributed, and exist under a variety of climatic conditions. Along the coast particularly, the glaciers are unusually sensitive and active, so that the response to what must be comparatively small changes in meteorological conditions are sometimes a surprising amplitude. Here in Alaska, problems related to glaciation ranging from the long-term changes measured in geological time to the minute year-to-year changes of the present time. In 1914, Lawrence Martin wrote, quote, "The Alaskan region is one of the most wonderful regions of glaciation in the world, both from the standpoint of number and size of its glaciers and from the extent and variety of associated phenomena." The end of the quote. We can only add this, that this is even more so today. At every international meeting where people gather to discuss glaciers, tremendous interest is shown in what is occurring in Alaska and what observations are being made. We cannot hope to solve the problems quickly, but I would suggest that a modest program of research carried on year by year, balanced between different types of observations, especially those in the upper parts of the glaciers, would produce useful results. The magnitude of the effort need not be large, but we do need continuity and a chance to plan well ahead. In this way, meaningful results may be attained most advantageously, and the group of enthusiastic and experienced observers can be kept active, and new methods and techniques can be devised and applied. While this subject is but a small segment of the study of our natural environment, it occupies a significant position in linking the disciplines which are concerned with changes in climate, modification of the landscape, the Earth's water budget, and the unfolding of the geological history of planet Earth. And now our little excursion into glacier problems is over. To you fellow members of the class of 61, may I extend my heartiest congratulations and best wishes for the years to come. I hope we shall all meet many times again on this lively and stimulating campus. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Field. You have spoken well on one of the changing aspects of our environment, the glaciers of the polar and subpolar regions. Now, we as citizens of the world do not exist alone, of course, in a physical environment. We act and interact with the people around us. Whether they are our neighbors on the next lot, at the next homestead, in the next nation, or on a neighboring continent. Man's life and the study of his varied ways of life are a science, too, a social science. And with this thought in mind, it is particularly appropriate and a very great honor for me to introduce to you today's second commencement speaker, a man of such preeminence and stature in the world today that whatever I might say here would be understatement. He is known, respected, and love for his creative genius as a social scientist, skilled in human relationships, and is a true leader. Perhaps a more concise word is guide among the leaders of the world's nations. He has served humanity in different professions as an educator, as a mediator, as a representative of our republic, as a servant of the peoples of the world. Speaking to us today, he is adding to the honor of the University of Alaska and to the 49th state. Ladies and gentlemen, it is my high privilege to present to you the second commencement speaker today, the Undersecretary of the United Nations, Dr. Ralph J. Bunche.
Thank you, President Wood, Mr. Rasmussen, Dr. Field, graduates, members and friends of the University of Alaska community. I salute you who are graduating today. This is your occasion, your day in the sun. All of you, beyond doubt, will have other hours of recognition along the up and down road of career and life, but none, I suspect, quite the same in emotional impact or insignificance as this one. Mine was in 1927, and I remember it vividly and with increasing nostalgia. How little of its true meaning and value did I then know. For my part, I am happy to be here with you on this day and to join with the graduates, their mentors, relatives, and friends in celebrating a joyous occasion. Joyous, despite the somberness of the garb which holy tradition rather quixotically dictates for the participants in this particular type of celebration. It is a further source of happiness to me, and also especially fitting, I think, that my first visit to this great land of the North, that is Alaska, should be to participate in a graduation. There is, I feel, for one who is hopeful, no more congenial occasion than a commencement. For my part, man of hope and peace that I proudly try to be, I am never so hopeful, even confident, as when I contemplate the youth of our land, or for that matter, the youth of every land, when I see the intelligence, the confidence, and the courage of youth, when I note their buoyancy and their bounce, And when above all, I observed the genuine concern for our world, both domestic and international, that is right and just and decent. We must remember and profit by the lessons of the past, of course, but I cannot escape the belief that the world would be a lot better off if we who grow older, as we all must, could be more forward-looking and less concerned with the past. The important thing is for every one of us of whatever age to look ahead and look up and to reach out. On such a special occasion as this, it is necessarily my aim to bring a message of earnest hope, without, however, intruding for very long upon the far more important proceedings which bring us all here. And thus I elect this morning to speak briefly of peace and the role of the individual in achieving peace and making it secure. This would seem to be an especially vital subject for those like Alaskans who inhabit the outer reaches of our country and who stand along its alert line. In my thinking, hope and peace are equated. For should the peace be lost to nuclear war, meaningful hope for man on Earth in any foreseeable future would be also shattered. The governments of the 99 states comprising the present membership of the United Nations, there will be a good many more in the months and years immediately ahead, these governments are becoming aware that a nuclear war with the weapons now available to the nuclear powers could, and no doubt would, obliterate completely all that we call civilization and would leave the survivors, and these could be very few, in conditions of life far darker than anything known to the Dark Ages and probably to the Ice Age. But I dislike talk of war. There need be no Third World War. War is not ineluctable. There is indeed, despite the most recent discouragements and setbacks, and these have been bad, a strong disposition among people everywhere to avert war. Peace, then, is both indispensable and attainable, although it must always be so clear that those who run may read that peace will never be bought at the expense of freedom or at the expense of the individual's birthright of dignity and right and self-respect. Peace, though there be, international tension is likely to be with us for a long time to come, I fear, and we must all adjust to the unavoidable conditions of that sort of existence. And now, what are the actual prospects for peace? What may there be to sustain hope? On the negative side, to be sure, the accounting is formidable. There is the Cold War, which has shown some signs of relenting in recent years, but since last summer it is being hotly waged again, in and out of the United Nations. The world will be in danger so long as it persists, and that will be as long as the clash between the two powerful camps of freedom and totalitarianism finds the latter motivated by a determination by force, if necessary, to dominate the world with its slavish mode of life. In saying that, however, I do not mean to condemn the struggle of ideology, which is valid so long as it receives force in peaceful competition for men's hearts and men's minds. The ideology of freedom, our ideology, should relish that kind of contest and should be fully confident of its outcome, unless those who are free, as we are, become complacent, abuse their own freedom, or begrudge its extension to others who have not heretofore enjoyed it. Recent months have seen serious crises posing threats to the peace in one or another form and degree, as in the Congo, in Cuba, in Laos, and Algeria. The danger potential of ad hoc situations such as these is very great and must not ever be minimized.
Still, they are perhaps too much featured in the news. They get more attention and arouse more anxiety than they properly should. The real problem, and the one which should claim the world's most serious and unceasing attention, is the condition underlying so many crises such as those just mentioned. That is the dangerous disparity in the level of life between those peoples of the world who have and those who have not, which in contemporary international circles is more delicately and, I believe, more accurately described as between the developed and the underdeveloped people. The gap between the one-third of the world's people regarded as developed, comprising mainly the peoples of Europe and our Western Hemisphere, and the two-thirds who are underdeveloped, comprising virtually all of the population masses of Asia and Africa, is unhappily not only wide, but it's a gap that is steadily widening. This situation, in my opinion, provides for the United Nations and for the world their sternest long-range test. It is, beyond doubt, a condition that is most ominous in its potential for restlessness, for desperation, for upheaval. The United Nations recognizes this and seeks to do something about it, but its present resources are pitifully meager. Here, I think, is where the true bonanza for peace must be ultimately struck. Thanks to the Cold War, no progress at all has been made recently toward disarmament or toward international control over outer space, and very little toward the suspension of nuclear tests, although the talks in Geneva go on their never-ending way. There have been, since last fall, continuous and violent attacks on the United Nations and upon the United Nations Secretary General, Mr. Hammarskjöld, assaults which have fairly tested the UN's durability. Suspicion and fear widely infect the attitudes of governments toward each other, and even more dangerously, the attitudes of people. Some 100 million people are still in the subject status of colonialism, and this is always a potential source of trouble. But colonialism, now mainly confined to the African continent, is in its vanishing stage, and before many more years will be a subject of history only. A major potential for trouble is the existence still in various parts of the world of bad relations among racial groups, involving policies of racial repression and practices of racial discrimination. Our own country is by no means alone in the problem of race relations. The problems of colonialism and of race, particularly, give rise to emotional reactions which readily lead to hostile attitudes and acts of violence. Causes of tension such as these are all interrelated, and each must be reckoned with in seeking to build peace securely. But there is, thankfully, also a positive side of the picture of contemporary world affairs, a side which affords solid ground for encouragement. I am neither hopeless nor dismayed in face of the immensity of the issues, the problems, and the tensions now confronting our world. Quite the contrary, for I am convinced that none of the tremendously difficult problems in the relations among peoples and nations is insoluble or unassailable. Indeed, so much of the record of United Nations intervention in conflict situations over its 15 turbulent post-war years gives convincing testimony to this effect. The world does progress, if haltingly and all too slowly. Faith is always a source of strength for the individual. And I do have faith that at least the good sense, if not always the goodwill in man, will prevail, and that humanity will not permit itself to fall victim to the fatal insanity of all-out nuclear war. There is nothing inherent in man's makeup, nothing biological, to impel him to such a calamitous course. It is in our environment only that needs changing. And mentioning environment, if you will permit me just a bit of levity, I would like to tell a story.
I do so because I'm from the United Nations, and there's also little humor in the United Nations. Although that situation, I must say, has improved just a bit since Adlai Stevenson joined us a few months ago. In connection with environment, I think of the story, the scene of the father and the son, both balefully looking at an obviously bad report card which the boy had brought home. The father was scowling, and the boy looked abashed and self-conscious. And then the boy turned and looked up at his father and said, what do you make of it, Dad? Is it heredity or environment? People have a will to peace, and by and large, they are peaceful until their emotions are aroused against someone or something. Only then can they be induced to support and fight war. It is the prime purpose of the United Nations to seek to harness this peaceful desire and to create of it an irresistible force against war. That objective, I think, is slowly being achieved, as testified to by the record of the United Nations itself. The United Nations, at times by mere desperate effort, has staved off numerous threats to explode World War III. In this regard, we readily call to mind the effective United Nations intervention in conflict situations in Indonesia, in Kashmir, in Palestine, Korea, Suez, Lebanon, and most recently, the Congo. It is this active intervention in a peacemaking capacity, where peace is menaced, which has given to the United Nations a dimension beyond that of a world forum. It is obviously only through development in this direction that the United Nations can become a true guardian of the world's peace. Yet almost incredibly, it is this very role that has made the United Nations, through the Secretary General and the structure of his office, the target of the vigorous attacks launched by the Soviet bloc of states last fall, launched to the cadence of Mr. Khrushchev's table thumping and the shoe pounding heard round the world, Arctic Circle no doubt included. The Soviet Union, you will recall, demanded a change in the position of the Secretary General from a single executive to a plural or tripartite executive, representing the capitalist, communist, and so-called neutralist blocks of state, although no one has ever been able to define the latter. This is a fundamental issue, since with a triple-headed executive, really an executive monstrosity in my view, operations such as that in the Congo would be hamstrung and actually impossible in any practical sense, for the daily decisions imperative to them could never be taken in time. I may assure you that Mr. Hammarskjöld, who is a remarkable man, has shown rare courage as well as brilliance in the face of these assaults. He's tough, and so is the United Nations. They have weathered the recent storms very well, and I have confidence that they will continue to do so in the interest of peace, and therefore in your interest and mine. Let us now cast a quick glance at a partial image of the world of this nuclear age, on whose threshold we are, the world in which these graduates must make their way, and the world which, in fact, you, the graduates, will have to run after you wrest its control from the old fellow who's been making rather a mess of it. Please note that I do not make the customary commencement declaration that you graduates are the leaders of the future, that the world belongs to your generation or generations. You will not inherit either of these positions by default, I can assure you. You'll have to compete staunchly for them. It's a world which, before long, will experience an atomic-propelled industrial revolution of universal dimension, a world in which two-thirds of its population, and how rapidly it multiplies, for whom misery and has been too much and too long a way of life, are demanding and must attain steadily better conditions of living, a world in which colonialism is coming to an end, with the creation of many newly independent states, a world in which the preponderance of its people, who are non-white, are at long last coming into their own with effective voice and vote in the community of states. In this new world, all peoples demand acceptance as equals.